As it has been true for a number of years now, it certainly is a joy and continues to be for me to be here at Sierra Vista and to share with you these studies as we have from time to time on other matters in the Lord's Word. It's good to see each of you who come from a number of places to be here, some from this state and some even from other states. Brother Jim Mayer is with us from Oklahoma City, and for that we're certainly grateful. He, Lord willing, will be with us for about a month, be with me for a month, you for 2 weeks. And then Brother Mickey from Durango, Colorado, plans to come in on Tuesday, Lord willing. And then, Lord willing, we'll have also a family from Alabama who will be here the latter part of the meeting. And so we're looking for some outsiders. But we're certainly glad to have you present, those from Tucson and those from other places who are here. It's a joy to have you. And I frankly am glad for you to come because I wanted to see you, and I'm glad I can. But in addition to that, I think that to what you're going to see this morning as we continue through this entire week as well, is going to be some spectacular knowledge and understanding and insight into what God had in mind over 2,500 years ago for our benefit. I noticed that in my studies of the book of Revelation, as well as Daniel and some of the other books of prophecy, it's given me a great deal of depth of insight I never could have had otherwise. Now, I've studied this book for 20 years, and these books for 20 years, and I purposely did not begin to study those until I was about 40 years of age. And the reason I didn't, I wanted to some 10 years before that time, because I knew it was deep. I realized that it had a great deal in it that I was not, at that time, capable of delving into with completeness. I felt like I needed time more to study, and I needed greater access to other information than I had. And I felt like I need maturity. So I purposely did not delve into it in depth until I was about 40 years of age. Now, I'm leading up to something you may notice in just a minute. It's taken some 20 years for me to arrive to where I am now in my understanding of it, and I'm not there yet. Every single time I talk on this subject, I learn something. And sometimes I won't tell you because it's in my mind the time I'm talking, and I'll see something I haven't seen before. There's just no end to the beautiful insight that God gives in these two books. And it's a joy, and always has been, for me to study these, and I'm continuing to learn, as you well know. I've been working on a book on this for probably 15 years. I purposely dug my feet because I realized that there were some things I would not have exactly right. And I realized I'd been making some mistakes in my insight into it. I realized as well, too, that there was going to be some things I would not have access to knowledge, some books, some charts, some history that I would not have insight into until I was older. I realized that events that were happening in the world at the time would probably fit very, very well in what was going on in Daniel's prophecies and John's. And so I purposely hesitated and drug my feet. Other brethren were insisting I'd get on with it, but I just didn't think it was time, and it hasn't been. Now, I've said all that to lead up to this. We mentioned making a book out of the comments that we're going to make this week. Well, let me go a little bit beyond that point. I'm delighted the brethren here intend to do that. I certainly am thrilled that you want to and have a part with it. However, I have had a transcript of 24 sessions on this, 24 in a row, for about 12 years. It's about an inch and a half thick, probably covers about 450 pages. That's already been in print for some 15 years. And it's something that I knew I had to revise. There's another transcript being made right now. There's another brother who's been wanting to publish this, and he has the financial means of doing so. So I think you can see that it's going to take a lot more time than just a matter of a couple of months to get it out. Because I'm going to have to merge about three different transcripts plus other material that I have available that I won't talk to you about into this. So it'll take quite a long while. It may well be I'm going to have to disappear to Mexico for about 3 months to get it done. I disappeared a time or two other places, but it didn't work. Southern Bell was able to find me, or South Central Bell, or Western Bell, whoever it is. And so consequently, I have not been able to nearly get through with the book. So by the time we're through with our study, we're going to have a lot more to tie together with it. So when we merge all of these transcripts that have been made and all of the other information that I won't use, together. In several months, I hope we can then proceed to really put out a book that I hope will be profitable. Now, nothing I have said for a moment do I intend to let you get the idea that I'm smart, because I'm not. These things that we're going to talk about have been in God's Word and in God's mind for over 2,500 years. Daniel began to write about these things in the middle of the 6th century B.C. So they've been here a long, long, long time. Men have looked at these things for centuries of time. They've wondered about them. They have stumbled over these things. They have, in their observations, written their thoughts, and historians have tied these in with history. So many of the things I'm going to talk about have been known for centuries, for over a millennium. Many of these things have been, so it's nothing new. But some things that we're going to talk about could not have been spoken of 20 years ago. Some of the things we're going to talk about near the end of our discussions are things that have just now come to light. And some of the things we're going to talk about have happened just before some of you were born, some of them after you were born. Now, we're not saying we're going to talk about anything spectacular in the sense that we've discovered great new things, but haven't. But God has seen fit in time to reveal these things little by little to us, so that now in our day, in our age, we're living in the most glorious age this world has ever known, as far as prophecy is concerned. Because we're now able to look into some things that others before our time could not possibly see. Daniel couldn't see all these things, and he said he couldn't. John didn't see all these things. He wrote them, but he didn't see them completely. And through the ages, men have not lived at a time when history would reveal them for us. So we're going to be able to see some marvelous things, and I'm thankful that you're concerned enough and interested enough to make this study possible. And I'm honored that I can have the opportunity to study with you in it. It's interesting to note prophecy is all about. Prophecy really is a lot more simple than many of us would, I suppose, think. And the reason I say that's because so many people, when they approach the study of prophecy, back off, and they say, no, we better not get into that. So when they study from Matthew down to the book of Jude, and they get to Revelation, so many brethren have said, now let's don't study that because nobody can understand it. And so they go back to Matthew again, and come back through and leave Revelation hanging in the air as though God wrote something that nobody can understand. First of all, that tells us that God did not have the ability to make it understandable, which, of course, is not true. And then he confused us by writing things we couldn't understand, which is also not true. And I think it displays also a talent that I don't like to admit, that is too many of us just plain lazy. We don't want to study. We want somebody to do it for us and to pour it out and so we can see it and enjoy it, and we don't want to study. And it takes a lot of study for these matters. But you have been those who have been studious, and we're thankful for it. We've seen a number of brethren also in recent times who have been able and have wanted to delve into the study of prophecy in the house. Brother Jim Mayer here has gone recently into a study of these matters, and his notes, which I have, are 8.5 by 14 long, and they're over an inch thick. So you can see that there alone, he has put a lot of time into it. Brethren up in New York have asked for copies of our notes, and they have recently gone into that. Brethren up in Tennessee have asked for those. Birmingham recently had a study on it. We had a study recently in Valley, Alabama, also in Midari, Alabama. So all over, Ben have seen fit to recently take a new look at prophecy. And, of course, the recent events in the Middle East have caused a lot of people to wonder where we are and what's going on. And, again, I want to commend you for your interest in this matter, and I think you're going to really enjoy what God has seen fit to reveal to us in this light of day. Time serves as an exact and a very unyielding judge of those who presume to study prophecy. Prophecy is not a thing in the world, but history written before it happens. And history is not a thing in the world, but a record of what has already happened. And when you take these two and lay them side by side, it just unfolds itself for you. And that's precisely where we stand in our study. We're not going to project ourselves into an area of speculation and a great deal of mysticism, as so many people have. For one thing, I don't think that's true and right in the proper way to approach it. I don't think God intended for us to speculate and guess on these things beyond the point of reason. I don't think we're finding things here that are going to be used by us just any way that we want to put them. Many times people take a verse of Scripture and they lift it from its setting and apply where it looks like it'll fit as opposed to where the context will have to fit. We're not going to do that. What we're going to do is read the words of prophecy and lay beside it the works of history written by secular men. Many of them did not even believe in God. Many of them would not for a moment accept Jesus Christ. But the fact is, they wrote what they saw. So we're going to use the works of secular history as a means of recorded fact of what took place, events that the world has recognized, and by means of history, use that to see what prophecy was all about. And you'll see then, again, that prophecy is a matter of what was going to happen written before it ever occurred, and history is a record of what did take place. So when we lay them side by side, history allows us to understand what prophecy was all about. And with that in mind, we might be able to project a little bit better what is ahead of us as far as possibilities. I personally think we are coming very, very close to the end of prophecy. I think prophecy was designed by God through Daniel and John to cover the entire spectrum from that time to the end of time. I think we're very near the end of it, and I think that most things that were predicted, and most things people have talked about throughout the era of time in the past, have already occurred. I feel that almost everything Revelation talks about has already happened. There are just a few things left, and we'll bring those out as we proceed. Now let me repeat myself. Time serves, though, as a very exact and a very unyielding critic of those who would presume to study prophecy, because time is true, and time tells you as it is what really is, so that things that I might say might happen or could happen, I'm not sure about, because I'm not a prophet inspired by God. No man on the earth has that ability today. And only time will make sure whether I'm right or wrong. And so what I say and what I suggest, if time proves through history to be correct, then of course I understood it properly. Understand then from what I've just said that I'm human. I'm not going to try to tell you that I'm right on everything. And you may not agree with every date I use. And that's certainly possible that I could be mistaken on some things. Understand that because I understand that. But I do appreciate you coming to get an idea of what the possibilities are about prophecy. Prophecy, I think, serves as a signpost along the road of time, and it also serves as a source of authority to either confirm or to disallow what we might understand. I think that as we begin the study of the book of Daniel, we need to, first of all, however, lay a foundation of what has happened and what's going on in Daniel's time, so that we might understand a little bit better where he's speaking from, what has taken place, so we might be able to see through his eyes the events of the day. And in doing so, it'll help us greatly as we proceed further in our studies. We go back in time to about the beginning of the 4th millennium B.C., and here we find a man on the scene called Adam, the first man who ever came into existence because he was created by God. You know the story, of course, of Adam and Eve and their descendants in the book of Genesis. As we come on down in time, you'll notice that there was a flood which destroyed the evil of the world because man had seen fit to transgress the will of God. And he has said that every thought and imagination of man's heart was only evil continual. I'll destroy man from the face of the earth whom I have created. And so the flood came to destroy man, with exception, though, that God saw fit to spare in his grace and mercy a man whose name was Noah. And those who would be influenced by Noah, it happened to be only seven of his own household. You remember the time then after the flood, which occurred about 2400 B.C., we have a man on the scene whose name was Abram. Now, I'll have a map here later on that we'll use to give you a great deal a better insight to what we're talking about. But in recent newspaper articles and private television, you've seen the Middle East pretty well pictured. Abram lived at a place called Ur of the Chaldees. This was just up the map about probably all 2 inches on most of your maps up there, full-size maps, from the northern edge of the area where the conflict has been today and the Arabian Gulf. He left Ur and went to the north and to the west and then finally back to the south. And in your history books back in your 5th and 6th and 7th grades, you've read about the Fertile Crescent. This was an upside-down moon, so to speak, that set between Ur on the northern edge of the Persian Gulf over to the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. And this is the route Abram took. As he went that way, he finally came into a place that was to later on be called the Land of Israel. And we use that name today, and we see it on the map today, and we'll talk about that later on in our studies. But at that time, it was called the Land of Promise. And the reason why is because in 1926 B.C., Abram was given a promise that unto you and to your children is going to be given this land. And you're going to have a great nation emerge from you. And from this nation will emerge one. Paul in Galatians 3 says, it was not seeds, but seed. One who will come to be the Savior of the world. So there God, through Abraham, is predicting the coming of the Messiah, which of course is ultimately what our story is all about. And what the entire scope of our discussion will be. Abram had a wife whose name was Sarai, but she had a handmaiden whose name was Hagar. And since Abram and Sarah did not have a child as soon as they would like to have had, and it seems that years are passing on and the child was not being born, and they wondered why, although the promise was given, although God was believed and he was trusted, somehow the child hadn't been born. And so Sarah suggested to Abraham, you take my handmaiden, and you have a son through her. And that'll fit in the plans that we have in mind, but that was not what God had in mind. Somebody said a while ago that we don't need to try to make plans for God because he just doesn't need it. He doesn't. We need to have patience. So Hagar, sure enough, had a son whose name was Ishmael. Ishmael, as time goes on, had 12 sons. And these 12 sons became the fathers of the Arab nations. It's interesting to note this, although quite often I don't think have had this brought to our mind. The Arabs are those who lived in the area completely surrounding what you know of today as modern Israel, all the way down to the very end of the Arabian Peninsula and all through the area, and then they began to migrate. And they went to the north and all through that part of the then known world. And you notice them today by various names. And back at that time, they were called by a number of the names of their forefathers and of others along the line whose names were mentioned back in the Bible. Edom, for example, and different ones who came from them. But they were scattered people. Now, the contrast between the Arabs, and we're not going to go any further on this in our study today, but the Arabs were a scattered people, whereas God, in the meantime, allowed Sarah to have a son when she was 90 years old and Abram was 100. And the name was Isaac. Isaac then had two sons named Esau and Jacob, but you know the story. Esau is the one who was red in color and skin, and it was from him the Edomites came. And then Jacob was the one who was the son of promise, and he was the father of 12 sons and one daughter. Now these 12 sons become the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel, but the contrast is they remained intact. They did not scatter. They stayed together as a group. Now, they had their separate land in which to live of the overall land of promise of Israel. But they stayed intact. And they had been an identifiable people throughout history. They did not live in the same place. They were scattered throughout the world, as we laid on study 2 from Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and also Romans 11. They were to be a scattered people, but they were to be intact as identity, and they remained that way. So where the Arabs scattered, the Israelites remained together as a group until later on in our study this morning you'll see. From the people of Israel then emerged one whose name was Saul. Now Saul was a son of, in time to come, a son of Benjamin, who was the last born son of Jacob. Saul became the first king of Israel. Beautiful things we can talk about in between, but time just won't allow. But anyway, Israel began to have kings. Saul was the first one, and the date was about 1100 B.C. You may differ with me some. Some people do on that. And he reigned for 40 years, and then you remember the story that he allowed David, his son-in-law, to marry his daughter. And actually, Saul now became the first king, but he was deposed because he transgressed the will of God. And the line of the kings then went over to the tribe of Judah, from which came David. Now, this was predicted back in the book of Genesis chapter 49. So even though Saul did this, he could have read, if he'd wished to, way back in the book of Genesis, where the tribe of the Judah was to be the tribe of the kings and not the tribe of Benjamin. But the first king was from Benjamin. He changed into David. He ruled for 40 years until Solomon came on the scene at David's death and reigned for 40 years. And then when Solomon reigned for 40 years and died, his son Rehoboam was the rightful king, and he began to reign as king. But there was a great little conflict, a conflict to the point at which the kingdom was divided between Rehoboam, the rightful king, and Jeroboam, a usurper to the kingship. The conflict was so great in about 980 B.C. that these two portions of Israel split into two groups. Now, the northern group, consisting primarily of ten of the tribes, called themselves Israel. They took the old name. But the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, along with the priest from the tribe of Levi, and some from Israel that did not go along with Israel, constituted a group called Judah. So they took the name of the predominant tribe. This consisted primarily of Judah, Benjamin, Levi, and some stragglers from the others. But Judah was a predominant group, and in time, the name Judah becomes Judea in the New Testament, and it's from this word, and these people, the word Jew comes from. Technically, you should never use the word Jew prior to this time, because it was never used in the Bible. Jew is a takeoff from the word Judah. The people following Jeroboam, and you can draw an imaginary line between an area just north of Jerusalem northward, and that would be where Israel was, and from Jerusalem southward would be where Judah was. They were led, first of all, by Jeroboam. He formed improper kings. He formed improper priests. He established improper places to worship, two of them instead of one, like Jerusalem. He had improper dates and improper observances. All these things were actually counterfeits of what was being done properly down in Judah. There were nine dynasties or families that had the kings of Israel come from them. They had 19 kings, and they were defeated in 721 by the Assyrians, who came down from where, well, you know of Nineveh, which was the capital. From Nineveh down, they conquered these 10 northern tribes. God would not let them come down and conquer the other two. God stopped them. He said, no, you can't go any farther. So Assyria came and conquered these northern 10 tribes, and they were assimilated among the Gentiles. Now, that's what happened to them. They came to an end, and we don't read of them anymore as an intact people. Some of them later on, they came mingled in with the Jews. But here they're not an intact people at all. So God has narrowed down now his plan to bring forth the Messiah to just a handful of people left, of the 10 tribes who have gone, and there's only two tribes left now. So Rehoboam was the rightful king. He dies, of course. In the meantime, other kings are born into the family of David and of Judah. There was one dynasty, which means simply the tribe, the kingship tribe of Israel never changed, the true kingship tribe from David on down to the very last king. One family, but there were 20 kings who made up that group, but they're still attacked now. In 721, when Assyria conquered Israel, Judah is still intact. It stays intact, remains intact until the subject of our study tonight, to this morning. We go on down from the time of Rehoboam to a king in 726 whose name was Hezekiah. Now, the reason I start with Hezekiah and skip some in between is because we're trying to take up 721 where Assyria conquered Israel. Hezekiah's on the scene in 721. He's followed by Manasseh in 697, by Amon, by Josiah, by Jehoahaz, who is on the throne in 609 B.C. Now, 3 years he reigned until 606. But in 606, Nebuchadnezzar comes from Babylon. If you want to tie it in a present day, of course, you can say Iraq if you wish to, because Babylon is roughly 50 miles south of Baghdad. So we're talking about the same area, the same Tigris, Euphrates River, the same area of the world, but of course, the different people. So Jehoahaz is on the scene, and then we find there is an invasion from Nebuchadnezzar in 606. Jehoiakim is on the throne. Now, Jehoahaz is replaced by the Pharaoh in Egypt by Jehoiakim, who's on the scene when Nebuchadnezzar now comes down and pushes Egypt out of the way, as it were, and then takes over that part of the world for himself. Now, it's at that time that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were their later names, are taken captive over into Babylon, where they stay. We never find Daniel returns. We never find Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do. But they are to be captives, Israel is to be captive over there for some 40 years. some 70 years. That's the first invasion made by Nebuchadnezzar down to the land of God's people. He didn't take all the people away. He didn't destroy the city or the temple, but he did wreak havoc among them and became their conqueror. However, there was then another invasion made in the time of Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin only reigned 3 months and 10 days. But Jehoiachin now, of course the descendant of Jehoiakim, is on the scene. And the second invasion made in 598 B.C. It's at this time that Ezekiel is taken captive and that Mordecai and Esther also are taken captive. Now you read of these, you read it first of all in Ezekiel chapter 1 verse 1 when that took place. Mordecai and Esther are spoken of in Esther chapter 2. It tells you when they were conquered. So the Bible very easily tells us these matters. We're just tying it in with world history. Oh, I should stop and say this. They didn't have a calendar back then like our calendar. So their calendars were based upon the reign of a certain king, or upon an earthquake, or upon something that took place. There was no continuous calendar. So the dates I'm giving are strictly our dates. They're not biblical dates, because there were no such things as biblical dates. So we have determine these dates from the birth of Christ. And there was a 4-year error there made, by the way. We'll talk about that later on. Anyway, the first invasion and the second invasion now. The people in Judah had become so opposed to the occupation of Babylon that they rebel. And so Nebuchadnezzar now comes with the third invasion in the days of Zedekiah, and he completely destroys the city, the temple, takes all that he wishes to possess back with him to Babylon, where Israel is to stay for 70 years. Now that was in 587, Zedekiah comes on the throne in 598, but in 587, after he'd been on the throne for a while, Nebuchadnezzar comes down, destroys Jerusalem, and that's the beginning of their 70-year captivity. Now, they are conquered in the first invasion and the second invasion, and of course the third. But they begin their captivity in the third invasion. Do you see the point? They were defeated people in the first and second, but they're taken away for 70 years in the days of Zedekiah in 587 when Jerusalem destroyed. Now you can read of this in the book of Jeremiah chapter 24 and Jeremiah chapter 25. I won't now because of time, but you can read a preview of these things going to take place, and they did, in a very, very beautiful way back in those chapters. Now, as we continue on, there are other books as well that tells us about these matters. Isaiah gives beautiful insight to it. Zechariah does. And just a number of other books give reference to what we've said. But I think we've given sufficient to see that these things God knew that was going to happen. He even predicted some of these things happening. And we now see evidence that it did happen just exactly as God said that it would. Now, it's with Israel, or Judah technically, because now they can assume that same old name they've been using throughout history, is conquered by the Babylonians. They're taken away from the land of their fathers. They have lived there with peace and joy and happiness, except the times when they disobeyed God, and then he's given them a spanking over and over and over again. This is the final spanking he gives them before there is a great onslaught and a captivity that goes on for 70 years. Now, in 587, exactly as Jeremiah said, and Daniel is going to tell us about this later on, then Judah returns in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they again build the temple and the walls and inhabit the city, and these people remain there from 517 up until 70 A.D. Now, it's good for you to make a note of that. Israel, or Judah, the Jews, remain an intact people there from 517 unto 70 A.D. Then they're taken and scattered and remain scattered until 1948. And God tells us in his word that would happen, and it did happen exactly that way. Luke 21:24 and Romans 11:25. We're going to talk about those people now who stayed there in that land during that period of time. And Daniel's going to give us a great deal of insight about what was taking place and then what would take place. So chapter 1 of the book of Daniel now is a setting that we look at. We haven't had the background of this. We begin reading with verse 1, chapter 1. In the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. Let me stop a minute. When I mentioned merging together these texts of various addresses we've made on this subject, I don't say the same thing each time. I don't even follow my notes. For one thing, I'd bog down if I did, and I'd just be taking a lot of time reading words. So I say what comes to my mind and some things that I'll mention this time I've never mentioned before. And I'll leave out a few things I know that I have mentioned before. So let me stop here and say something I don't think I've ever mentioned before. You're going to read in the books of the Old Testament the word Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuchadrezzar. Now, these are two different spellings and pronunciations of the same man. However, Daniel is the only one who uses the term Nebuchadnezzar from its original language. Every one of the others use a little different word. And the other references in the Bible are this. But we're talking about the same man, just a different spelling, a different pronunciation according to where you're coming from. So Nebuchadnezzar is the man we're speaking about, and he comes to Jerusalem now in 606 B.C., the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. He gained a besiege, and of course he was successful. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his gods, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes. It seems to me that what we are finding is a beautiful idea that Nebuchadnezzar has, and probably a very, very wise practice on his part. If a capturing king is wise enough to realize he's not going to dominate a captured people without opposition. But if he takes some of the young men and women of that captured nation and can develop them to the point at which they have a very good relationship with them, they can have a lot to do in maintaining control of those people. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. He takes these young men, outstanding young men, and he's going to tutor them, and they're going to be very, very valuable instruments for him. And later on we see that God is behind the law because they're going to become very, very valuable instruments for God in his plans and his purposes. And so Daniel now is chosen with his companions to be of this select group. Verse 4 tells us that they were to be children with in whom there was no blemish, but well favored, skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. The king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. You remember that when Esther was brought before the king, she too was set aside for a while for purification and for some of the things we might someday talk about. But the fact is, these boys were set aside now too. They might be in a prime position when they're brought before the king for 3 years out of this study. I don't know how old Daniel was. I would like to know, but I don't. I do know that he must have been old enough to have in some way impressed the people who chose him. But now he's to be there for 3 years, so he'll be somewhat of age when he comes before the king. Now, verse 6 says, among these that were chosen were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, on whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. He gave to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, unto Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. This gives us the setting now of why these four young men are where they are, and why now they are presented with a problem. Now recognize the fact they're Jews. And being Jews, they are prohibited by God of eating certain things or being contaminated with certain things. And from their youth, they have known this, and they have been accustomed to following the will of God. Now they're exposed to things that they don't enjoy because they realize God's not pleased with it. And so Daniel very boldly stepped forward, I think, and it looks to me like he is going to be a very outstanding young man, as we later on see he is. Verse 8 says, but Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat. The word meat, as it's used in the Old Testament, I don't recall ever a single time being used to refer exclusively to flesh. Now, the word meat means food. And we quite often today use it to mean flesh. And it could have included flesh, I suppose, back then, but I don't recall that it ever was used exclusively that way. So he's exposed now to what the Babylonians would have eaten, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now the prince of the eunuchs had taken a liking to Daniel. Daniel had apparently impressed him in such a way that there would be reason for there to be some type of a communication that would be very favorable. Verse 8 now tells us that Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat. So he goes in, the Bible tells us, to the prince of the eunuchs and desires to have an exception made in their case. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs, and the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my God, my Lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces, whose liking, worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. So the prince of the eunuchs says, now, if you do what you want to do, and if I let you do what you want to do, then I endanger myself, because I've been told what to do. And if I don't do what I ought to do, I could be killed myself. My head could be cut off. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. Let them give me pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them and the matter, and proved them 10 days. Daniel says, now give me a chance to prove that you're not being in any danger, and we're going to be well off, and everything will be well and fine if you just do what I say, but allow 10 days to be the time at which you're determined this. Daniel has been well favored by this man. God has seen fit for that to occur, and so that opportunity is given. The word pulse, and probably in Spanish it would be pulse, is a word I think we need to look at. It's used several times in the Bible. One of those is back in the book of 2 Samuel chapter 12. And here, let's see, chapter 17, I believe, and in verse 28, the word is used, and there it is, in our King James Version, the word pulse, but also before that is the word parched. And the King James Version, the word pulse is not there. It's added by the translators. But the word parched is there. So this is a word that denotes something apparently that has been parched in the original language. Later on, though, also in the book, in the references given in a number of commentators about this matter, they have researched the matter, they have determined that this is a meaning in the earlier language. This would be, in this case, in the Hebrew. Now, from chapter 2 to chapter 7, we're going to find that the book of Daniel is written in Chaldean. But in the Hebrew part of this, the word pulse is a word that comes from something that has been sown. Of course, what do you sow? You sow seeds in a garden. So if you have something sown, it implies then this is vegetable. So consequently, they're not going to eat the flesh that probably would not have been killed properly. It might have had blood mingled with it. And so he saw fit to eat, Daniel saw fit to eat vegetables. Very understandable. Nothing wrong with that. Everything good about it. And so he would have not violated the will of God in doing so, and he would have, at the same time, been in accord with the wish of the king. So they are going to eat something that was called pulse. Other references are given about this matter, but I think that's sufficient to let us notice what he was eating and why he was eating that and the intent he had behind his request. Then in verse 16, we find, thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king said he should bring them in, this would be after 3 years, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like these four. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. We're going to find he continues beyond that time. But the fact is, he continues that far. So we're saying here that Daniel continues throughout the entire reign of the Babylonians, and he is well blessed and serves God well during that period of time. I think it would be interesting now for us to see something about the captivity of these people also, and to let you see that God has not forgotten them, and God is going to remember them, and to get an idea of the feeling they had about their captors. You might want to turn to the book of Psalms, chapter 137, and we'll begin with verse 1. Now, the writer of this particular Psalms was not David, of course, because he's long since passed. And no doubt it is of someone there, I don't know just exactly who. It doesn't tell us. But of someone there who's experiencing the memory of Israel and God's people in the present land they lived in, and are now there being in bondage unto their captors. Psalms 137, verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there they carried us away captive, required of us a song. They might, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing ye one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above, my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom, in the day of Jerusalem, who said, rise it, even to the foundations thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. That's cruel, but listen to what happened. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Here the writer of Psalms is thinking about the time when this 70 years is going to be ended. We're going to be free from this captivity, and God's going to take vengeance on Babylon and give them what they deserve. We can read of this in several other places, but I think because of time, likely I should not now do so. But there are predictions, and Zechariah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, that Israel now is going to come back to their land, and God now is going to turn his wrath on Babylon and destroy Babylon and bring it to its knees, which of course he proceeds to do very, very quickly. I think probably judgment tells me to stop at this moment. I'd like to go on, and I intended to go on and cover the second chapter of Daniel, but I do want to cover it thoroughly, and I think probably that with that in mind, I had better do that tonight. Somebody asked me how long I was going to talk this morning and how long the tapes would be before I had to change them and so on. I told them I didn't know. I think you can see why. I get started, I might not stop when you want me to, and I might get involved in something, and I don't know just when I'll stop. And so we will stop now, Lord willing, and continue this tonight. But I would like for you to read chapter 2 today sometime before we get to it tonight. And Lord willing, we may go farther than that. At least I want you to read up through chapter 6. Because I know we'll make a break at that point. Probably, I'm sure we won't get that far tonight. But read chapter 2 through chapter 6 and be prepared for our next studies. Again, let me say it's been extremely good to have you here. You've shown very good interest this morning. You've shown good interest by being here. I appreciate your taking notes. Now, some of the things that I'll say, I may not give you a reference, or you may not understand the reference I give. I may say it too fast, or I may slur the word. And if you want to have that information, come to me after services, and I'll give you the reference that you want. I'd like to prove everything I say. None of these things I'm going to say, I'm going to guess at, Lord willing. I'm going to have something that I can back up what we say. So if you need some references that I don't give, by all means ask for those, and we'll be happy to give those to you. I think then, from what we've seen thus far, you can see that we have a great deal of background that we have covered to show us where Daniel is. Daniel now is living at a time in the middle of the 500s B.C. What he's about to do is tell us of the dreams that various kings had who reigned over him, but all of those who used him in a marvelous way for their benefit and for our benefit. So the first chapter gives us the background. Chapter 2 through chapter 6 gives us their stories, which you've been told as children love, the beautiful stories that are true. But each of those give us the story of the visions of the kings who lived at that time, who Daniel knew personally, and they pointed to events, some of them future, but events which all took place during the times that were then current, the time of Daniel. Now, all these things were about a time that surrounded Daniel's life on the earth as a human being. Then, from chapter 7 through chapter 12, you have visions that Daniel saw. These others are other visions, other dreams, and other events that took place. Nebuchadnezzar, or Belshazzar, or some of those men who were around Daniel. But from chapter 7 through 12, we have Daniel's visions, and these are visions, are things that were to occur from that time unto the end of time. Daniel talks about that. Daniel really comes along then and lays the foundation so that having a good solid foundation built, when it's time for revelation, John comes and sits it right smack top of what Daniel's already prepared. Now, I don't know a lot about your building here, but I presume you have a foundation on this building. And with this foundation which you dug in the ground, you made sure that you have something solid to build on. I built foundations on other buildings. In some cases, I had to build a very broad and wide foundation because there was not a lot of good structure underneath it to build on. The fact is, you have to have some kind of foundation or your building won't stand. I'm sure you have that in this building. Same thing's true here. Daniel's not a thing in the world but a foundation. It is a beautiful foundation, a very lovely foundation, but it is a foundation that these people then used then. But we today, 2,000 years later also, have something built in that same foundation that's solid and sure and exact, and we're going to take the benefit of it in our next few studies, particularly when we get to the book of Revelation. Because John tells us the same thing Daniel did, but extended even farther than Daniel did. And of course, the same author, the same engineer, the same architect of both the writings of Daniel and John is God. I think you need to notice this too, though, that when we look at chapter 1 through chapter 6, we're going to see some kings mentioned who also are mentioned later on down here. And so you might say, as some people do, no, wait a minute, that couldn't be that way because it's not in chronological order. It's not intended to be. So when you read Daniel and you read about a king here, then another king taking his place, and a third king taking his place, then later on the same king mentioned over here that you mentioned earlier, don't get confused. It's designed that way, put together that way, because the first six chapters talk about the vision of the kings, then the entire thought changes to now talk about the visions of Daniel because God through him is telling us what the future events are to be. The vision of the kings first, the vision of Daniel second. Now, one of the beautiful visions, and one of the things we're going to really delve into tonight in detail, is the second chapter, the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, the great and mighty king of Babylon, and one of the greatest kings the world has ever known. It's been good to have you. Appreciate so much your interest. Be sure and ask questions because we're here to learn. I'll learn. I'll see some things I haven't seen yet this week. I'll see some things I haven't learned yet about, and they'll become known to me. And I'll profit from it. And certainly glad to have your interest and hope we all can join together in growing spiritually. We might be better able to see the beautiful things God has in mind for us. One thing about these studies that I've always enjoyed seeing, and it's been true of me every time I've studied these, is that you don't have to have Daniel in Revelation to go to heaven. It helps. You don't have to have them. You can learn the truth like the man on the road from Jerusalem did to Gaza. He was a man who didn't know the truth. He didn't understand the truth. He was told about Jesus Christ as a Savior. If you can't read a word of English or Chaldeic or Greek, you can still learn the truth by somebody telling it to you. You can be saved by hearing and knowing about Jesus Christ. But these books of prophecy give us a great deal of insight we would never get otherwise. And I think by the time these studies are ended, you'll see that you have a deeper, broader, more glorious view of Christianity that you didn't even know existed. Been that way with me. There's insight to God's provisions and plans. There's encouragement. There's patience. There's understanding that I never did have until I was able to delve into these things. And I think you'll find the same thing too. I think you're going to find a genome here that we need to uncover. And when you do, Christianity will never be the same. It'll be greater. It'll enhance your understanding. It'll also enhance your desire to go to the place we're going to picture in the last few chapters of Revelation. Beautiful way pictures heaven, our eternal home. today I would like to hope that every person here is a member of God's family and have the hope and joy and peace that only God's family can have of a life of His presence here, but in His presence and hereafter. This morning, if you're not a Christian, though, may we encourage you to become one. You don't know what living's all about until you are a Christian. True, you might not have all the temptations or problems or difficulties Christian has. But the Christian has something about his problems he can see through. He has an answer for his problems you don't have otherwise. So by becoming a Christian, you won't lose your problems. You won't lose the fact you have to earn a living or live in a material world, but you will have a vision of what happens beyond this world and the glories of heaven yet to come. If you're not a child of God, I encourage you this day to acknowledge your faith in Jesus Christ, be baptized into His body, the church, and join with us in the Christian hope. Would you make your wish known while we stand and sing?